Staggered down the hatch. Never fear, I am here. And tonight's salute to Steve Allen is brought to you as a special service of this totally concerned avenue of human communication. Bring it up the figure. You don't mind if I perform the following program wearing my totally black shades, do you? Better not to see you, my dear. I'm telling you, it's a sickening scene. Listen to this from Salt Lake City. You wouldn't suspect it in Salt Lake City. Sheriff's Deputy James M. Baker, who was questioning a youth in connection with a minor traffic accident, and we all know that youth is beautiful, suddenly asked in the middle of his questioning, "Okay, where's the marijuana?" The surprised 16-year-old driver instantly handed over a packet of pot to Baker, who at the moment was having an unbelievable sneezing spasm. The deputy said he is allergic to only one substance, marijuana. There's the perfect cop. He's got the perfect illness. Would you please bring that out? We'd like to sue him. Come on, guys, bring it in then. Bring the music in there. It ain't easy being alive today. Hooray for me, yes sirree, I am unbelievably. Hooray for me, this is a total ego trip. Hooray, hooray for all the things I do. I am so sensitive and so beautiful and true. Thank you, gang. Thank you. Please recue that. While you're doing that, you'll get some of my little bitches out of the way there. Let's see. We got a Miller High Life spot here today, friends. I'm tired of telling you that the only thing better than 6 bottles of Miller High Life beer is 12 bottles, but I'm going to warn you something. This is Friday, right? What is worse than almost, what's worse than a total case of accident? I mean, you know, from the top of your head all the way down to your feet. Well, I'll tell you what it is. Running out of beer on Saturday afternoon. And you don't want to do that, friends. So when you go out tomorrow, be sure to lay in plenty of that good, rich, unbelievably ripe, deep down, magnificent beer flavor. Miller High Life. Make sure you lay in a trough for the whole weekend. You don't want to be caught short Sunday evening, you know, with nothing open and all that. You're running around your tongue, you know. That's Miller High Life. You want to make this weekend sing. Yes, sir. Miller makes it right, friends. Look for it. Miller High Life, brewed in Chet Cairn, Mississippi. Oh, no, that can't be. That just can't be. Yeah, that was nice, wasn't it? Listen, speaking of that top of the pot there, there's a lot of problems with the law today. A little thing here. San Francisco newspaper delivery man William Stanley, 22, investigating a burlap bag in the middle of the street. But not for long. It contained 6 pythons. Man, that would really flip your cork, wouldn't it? Open up a burlap bag you find in the street and 6 pythons jump out. And it says the littlest one was 4 feet long. You should have seen them other babies. It says police are puzzled over this. No one reported losing 6 pythons. And they're puzzled. There was a note in it. In the bag, it said, and we quote, "The scientific name is Regis Python. The common name is Python. Sell as many as you can, but try to save one for me." Let's see. Crime strikes again. Oh, everywhere you look, evil is beginning to pop up its sneaky head, friends. And aren't you a little bug that you're missing out on it? Have you done anything really evil lately? Or have you been straight as a pin? You know, walking around there. I think one of the reasons why, invariably, you know how movies always treat guys like Jesse James? It's always beautiful, you know? I mean, they're beautiful to everybody who gets slugged back by them, you know? That's beautiful. You know, it's like Jesse James is beautiful, the Dalton boys are beautiful, and all that stuff. Well, it's because we secretly envy criminals. I believe we do. How many of these books, you know, you read these books, how many books have you read recently on the mafia? We've been reading books on the mafia lately, you know? Well, you read these books, and you secretly envy, you know, these guys driving around in a great big long black Cadillacs and carrying them Roscoes and say, you know, the whole bit. What do you do? You're working across the county department, and you work this little machine all day long, and your feet hurt, and where are you going to go, you know? Your biggest excitement of the week is missing the 536. And that's illegal to many guys, don't you? Many guys, the laws are far bigger than laws, you know, with many people. I mean, I'm talking about there's public law and there's private law. Now, what is private law? Listen, there's many a guy that is in trouble, like so you couldn't even believe it, if he misses a train and gets out to Westport 12 minutes late. So all hell breaks loose. You know, the martinis get warm, everything. And, you know, the kids yell and, you know, he's supposed to go to a Little League ball game and all that jazz. Here he is, 12 minutes late. What's he been doing? He's been fooling around. Breaking a law. Missing a train. Hey, do you mind if I play a little bit on my 1883 Jews harp? Oh, isn't that a beautiful sound? Isn't that lovely? Listen, it's an 1883 Jews harp that was sent to me by one of my listeners. Look, Rococo Jews harp. That's true. It's almost 100 years old. What's this? That's the control you can get on it, baby. Can I play a little bit with it? Would you please bring me a little bit of that music on it? Hold it. Yeah, it's a nice song. You know, the guy that sent me this Jews harp, he sent me a letter with it. He said that this has been up in their attic. And he said it's been up in this big trunk. It was left by his grandfather. And he said, it's been in the trunk, you know, with a lot of old stuff they had, like old beaver hats and junk. And he says, this actually was his great-grandfather's. Grandfather's father, and it's been up in the attic there all this time. He says, so we've been cleaning out a lot of junk, and he said, this used harp is up there, and he says, nobody in the family could ever conceivably play it. It's a tough one. This is a really classical one here. Beautiful used harp. And he says, this used harp has probably not been played by anybody seriously, quite possibly since the turn of the century. He says, it's probably not been played by anybody for a good 70 years. And, it's a great sounding Jews harp. Now, you want to hear the difference between this? Here's a contemporary Jews harp. I'll play a good contemporary Jews harp. This is a good... You notice the difference in shape and all that. This is a contemporary guitar, but a good one. It has a deep, mellow tone. And, it's got a tone that persists, you see. Whereas this one here, which is a harder, sharper tone, and incidentally, is much more of a country jew's harp. This is the kind they use in, really good country and western groups and so on, where you get a real cutting sound, and you can hear a jew's harp like this for blocks if it's properly played. Now, here's the old one, the 1883 American jew's harp. You notice, for one thing, on the old jew's harp, you get a wider range. You can actually have, note-wise, you have a wider range, and there's a little more control over it. Listen up. See, that's the old baby, 1883. Now, listen to this. Here's a contemporary Smith. Yeah. I just thought you... Hey, listen, speaking of... we got a lot of business here before we got to get out to our... we got a real serious story here for tonight. A very serious story. I've been meaning to tell this for a long time, and the time is now right to do it. Certain stories are so traumatic that the teller can't really get around to them and, just retell them. And I have a story tonight. It's such a traumatic story that it's not going to be easy. Well, before we do that, though, we've got a couple of little bitties for you. We have here a Datsun commercial. And what more can I tell you? Except that if you're planning to buy a car, because, a car is like a lot of things, very personal. There's not much you can say to a person about it. You have to experience it. In other words, what can you say about a 1932 straight-eight Packard? I could sit here and talk about it for hours. But if you sit in the front seat and grab a hold of the steering wheel, then you got something else going, It's an experience. It really is true. And so whatever you say about a car is kind of shallow stuff, because they all say the same thing. Almost every car says economical, beautiful, great, young ideas. They all say the same jazz. But I can only say one thing about the Datsun, that this car has swept the West Coast. And practically every third car, it seems, when you're out in L.A., is a Datsun, because they have a lot of mountains and they have a lot of wild driving going on out there. And it's also an economical, solidly built, beautifully designed automobile. And if you are going to buy a car this year, wait until you see the new Datsun, particularly that new magnificent 240Z sport car. And if you'd like to see one in Connecticut at Brown Car Town, 308 Lindley Street in Bridgeport, or if you're in New York, Hempstead Datsun, 185 Main Street in Hempstead, of course, you slob. This is WOR, New York. Do you have that commercial in there for adventure? Hit it there.
Oh, here it comes! Help! Help!
Once in a lifetime
has been left out of the adventurers. Harold Ruffin's sensational bestseller.
A lot of stuff they should be.
Now the screen's most incredible entertainment.
Oh, no,
the crew has made lots of
seen some incredible pictures.
Not yet. Dash. Also here. Cat. The beautiful people. The fire people. New York fire as real humans.
I can hardly wait to see this.
The adventurers.
Oh, really?
Here. All of it.
That's a great writer, Harold Robinson.
Josephine McGill presents
the movie. He's a fantastic
one. The Adventurers. Nothing has been left out of The Adventurers. From Paramount, rated R, under 17.
Rated R. The Adventurers. Let's see. Now at the DeMille, 34th Street, East, and Louis Orpheum Theater. Who's that Louis? Who's that DeMille, huh?
Nothing like a Harold Robbins novel.
Oh, that's great. Listen, I know a guy that kept his house warm one entire winter in his fireplace by just burning three of them. They burn slow. They're nice blue flame. Let's see. We have here... Oh, hey, listen. How many of you are fans of medical journalism? No. Do any of you... One of the things that I like to do sometimes, if you ever go to a doctor's office for a physical checkup or something like that, you got to go to get your insurance checked and so on. You sit in the... in the lobby there, and he's got all these great medical magazines on, like one called Guts and You, that kind of stuff. You and Your Liver. And so I rarely see this kind of stuff. You don't see it in the newsstands. And these are really underground papers, truly underground papers. And by the way, isn't that one of the great laughs of our time? Every paper that calls itself an underground paper is available on every Times Square newsstand. It's the first time in history, you know, that you can get a lifetime subscription of an underground newspaper by clipping the coupon out of the Times and sending it in. However, speaking of the underground, would you please, give me a little of music. We're going to need it here for just a second. Here, let's go. Hooray for Princeton, yes, sir. Hooray for culture, yes, sir. Yes, sir, culture's coming to Princeton University. Oh, the Ivy League is coming with the talk. That's enough. Hold it. That's enough. That is by way of an introduction to a little note that we are going to do a big show, our yearly show. It's become almost a tradition type thing. And boy, I'll tell you, it's the wildest show, I think, outside of the town hall show that I did all year, the big one at Princeton last year. And if you are in that, in that area, you'd like to make a scene, it's going to be April the 3rd. I know this year preferably didn't include any of that in material here, but it is April 3rd. It's at 8 o'clock. And it's going to be at Alexander Hall in Princeton, New Jersey. Now, I repeat, April the 3rd. What day is that? Is that a Friday night? That's a Friday night, April the 3rd, Alexander Hall, Princeton, New Jersey. And all seats are $2.50. And it's being sponsored by the university radio station at WPRB, which is a deeply concerned radio station. They worry, they sweat, though. And by the way, this is your last chance to order them by mail. Obviously, it takes about, you know how the mail is these days. So you send a check or a money order for however many tickets you want. They're $2.50 a piece, $2.50. You send it to Shep. That's what they want to put on it. SHEP, Box 342, Princeton, New Jersey. I repeat, you send your check or money order to Shep, Box 342, Princeton, New Jersey. Now, the tickets will be held for you. They're not going to mail them back. Because if they tried to mail them back, friend, you wouldn't be getting your tickets before the 4th of July. You know how it is. So they'll hold the tickets there at the door, and you must pick them up no later than a half an hour before showtime. So I repeat, the address again is Box 342, Princeton, New Jersey. And you said you're checking money order, okay? All right, that's April the 3rd, 8 o'clock, for Friday night, Alexander Hall, Princeton, New Jersey. And by the way, you have never seen Princeton. A lot of people who came to the show last year, it's the first time they ever actually were on the campus of Princeton. To me, Princeton University is one of the, it's almost the quintessence. You ever been on that campus side at all? You ever seen it? Well, you should, really. Princeton is the quintessence of the picture university. It looks exactly the way an Ivy League college or university should look. It's just there. It's a perfect thing. And it's like, in its way, it's an art form in itself. You know, here it is. It's the university. Just like Capitol buildings look like Capitol buildings. You know, the White House looks like the White House. Well, this place is like the ultimate campus. And I've been on plenty of campuses, but man, this is a real campus, Princeton. And so a lot of the people that were there last year had never been, on the campus. Of course, most of the people there were students, but a lot of people came who had never been on Princeton's campus before, and they were gassed. And you walk around, and you could hear the sound of ghostly ukuleles playing in the, you could hear the sound of F. Scott Fitzgerald opening another bottle of rare bourbon. You could hear that. You used to hear it coming out of the ivy. And then you walk around the campus and you say, oh, man, this is... And then you get really mad when you think of where you went. Oh, boy. I'll tell you, I went to a school that looked a little bit like... Well, I'll tell you, have you ever seen... you've driven around Route 22. Have you ever seen two guys from Harrison? Looked exactly like my university. I mean, there's that school of architects, they pile bricks one on top of the other until they get to the right height, and then they stop. See, that's about it, see? Then they put a couple of Reynolds wrap frames in there, and they stick some wiggly glass in it, and that's the quad. It gives a little sound there, quad. And above it, they have a Latin inscription, which nobody reads, you see. And somebody, they put about five Latin words, like in hoc agricola conc, or in est spit lout. And you finally decipher it when you're in Latin class, and it turns out, don't spit on a farmer, you see. And you realize they've been putting you on, see, because it's, through these gates come the most unwashed redneck farmers in the world. You know, have you ever been through in a restaurant where they say, through these doors come the most beautiful people in the world, and all that stuff? Indeed. Yeah, but anyway, that's the way. Yeah, so when you go to Princeton, you say, for crying out loud. Why isn't it? You can just see Jack Oakey dancing on the table. You know, in the old library there with Betty Grable coming out with a sweater. But nevertheless, that's neither here nor there. The reason I brought up the medical thing today, I'm going to have to mention this thing of the medical thing. A doctor sent me this. It's a chef. The other day you talked about that lady that got the leak in the silicone. You know, this lady was suing the guy. She was suing the doctor because she had one of these jobs done, you know. And she'd sprung a leak and the silicone was leaking out. Very embarrassing. And the doctor says, well, you haven't been keeping up on the latest developments. And it's the doctor, see. So he sent me this article out of Modern Medicine, March 9th, 1970. Now, that's really contemporary, right? And it's written by Eric R. Sanderson, M.D., Seattle. And the title of this piece is, and this is in a medical journal, a real official medical journal. You can see all these doctors sitting around reading it, you know, very seriously. It's what up front that counts. article in a medical journal. At hand today, and to be regarded with concern, is a feature article from our daily paper detailing the expense involved in surgical cosmesis. To keep abreast of the times in our cleavage-conscious society, vast hordes of women present themselves to the cosmetic surgeon for, quote, enhancement, it says. More, they cry. Give us more. And such is the demand for pectoral prominence that they can be persuaded to lay down $700 or more in the hope that the fuller life with its attendant uplift, spiritual and otherwise, will make them feel good all over. That's for two, of course. $700, not each. Despite the basic feminine urge to bargain, there seems to be no reasonable way to beat the going rate. Not often will the girls want just one at half price. And haggling to get three for the price of two would be pointless and redundant. So $700 it is. You never would expect this kind of stuff in a medical journal. More these days consists of two plastic, if you're curious what the operation is, consists of two plastic beanbags filled with silicone, slipped almost surreptitiously between the old flap disc and the pectoral fossa beneath. Proponents of today's prosthesis will tell you that this technique is infinitely superior to the crude attempts of yesteryear. You may recall only a few years ago when all it started. You could put in a collect call to Hollywood, where else, and arrange for two large injections of liquid silicone on a while-you-wait basis en route to Disneyland. The technique was simple, but it fell out of favor when it was found that the liquid had a distressing tendency to flow elsewhere. One amorphous blob somewhere around the navel, instead of two on the chest, had to be an unsatisfactory end result. Something thicker than water was needed. Something that could be nailed down and would not wander all over the place was required. It was produced quickly in response to demand by patient and cosmetic surgeon alike. Implants of various sponge-like plastics came next, cut to size with loving care and stitched in place. There they sat, soft and seductive, but not for long. The local fibroblasts thrived in this environment, and they invaded the interstices. All too often, a nice primary result ended up like two knobbly feeling coconuts, at least one of which was facing in the wrong direction. I don't know whether this is hitting you as funny as it's hitting me, but this is this is a doctor, you know, talking about his own profession. So today's, let's bring on a little triumphant music, please. Would you please get me my record there with the yellow label, please? We need a little triumphant music with the yellow label, you know, with the marches on it. That's right. And get me some good triumphant stuff, like the El Capitan. That's a good triumphant march, right? Medicine is marching forward to enhance the richer, deeper, fuller, the larger, richer, more upfront life that everybody wants. So just please bring it in any time. You don't have to cue it up. Just lay it down in the middle of El Capitan. So today's newer and better internal prosthesis promise to serve a dual purpose. On the one hand, they fill a void, as it were. On the other, they replace the older techniques, which must be looked upon in retrospect as dismal, sometimes totally embarrassing failures. Small wonder the new is now being greeted with such total enthusiasm. To those of us who know how much first-rate surgical care $700 will buy in the general surgical market, the fee seems a bit stiff for what must be classed as a relatively simple procedure, but the cosmetic surgeons point out that they're selling a luxury item. Yes,
the patient can take it or leave it. And the fair price of any such luxury service is what the customer is willing to pay. And then, too, the cosmeticians have been accused of thinking more largely than most of us, with published quotations of $1,500 for a partial facelift, maybe $1,000 for a good nose job, and even $500 for quietly elevating a drooping eyelid. Those of us who don't do these operations find it easy to raise a whole eyebrow at the entire matter for no charge at all. Yes, and here is the editorial. It makes you wonder about relative values, though, doesn't it? For the medical necessities such as relief of pain and restoration of function and return to active duty in the workforce, the drive is on to reduce the cost of medical care. For the medical luxuries that feed the ego, the fee is what the traffic will bear. Cosmetic surgery is not covered in surgical fee schedules, so you can get what you ask. He says, don't forget, friends, you may have missed the boat. You went into the wrong field. If you were in search of dough, you should have realized the simple truth. Please, reset that right in the middle. You don't have to cue it up. Listen to his last line, and I think all of us should remember this. It is what's up front that counts.
Very good. That was a funny bit. I bet a lot of doctors got mad. And you should see the illustration they got there with it. They got an illustration of a lady with about five nice big ones. She's mad. The doctor's looking scared. So, you know. I read that thing. I just gotta relay this. You don't often find professional people with a sense of humor about their profession. Oh, no. Let me say, very few engineers. I'm talking about electrical or digital engineers find anything but tremendous importance and formalism in their field. And now, have you ever read the Plumber's Monthly? Oh, they're serious. You try to get funny about the Plumber's Helper, and I'll tell you, you're talking about a religion there. One of my favorite magazines is the Undertaker's Quarterly. That's a good one for laughs. Oh, they have, you should see the cartoons they've got. No, I'm serious. Now, that crowd does have a sense of humor about what they do. And you know, I don't know whether I like it. Nevertheless, you know, life is hey. I've often felt, and you need to listen to this here, friend. I've often felt that, you know, you take what we call the theater of the absurd today, and which is not that kind of a, you know, it's a term that's in kind of disuse now, but quite often the theater of the absurd is exactly the way it is. I remember one time I went to a play. In fact, I was in this play later in its run. I was there because I was supposed to be watching it because I was going to go into it. And it was down in the village, and it was a play by Ionesco, who is a European playwright, and he's supposed to be, you know, theater of the absurd and all this stuff. I sat in the theater, and for the first time in my life, people were talking the way people really talk. Like there was a scene, see, of this man. And this is the part I was playing, actually. There was a scene with a guy, and he's sitting there with this lady, and they're sitting in a living room. And it's a living room, you see. They've got a set that looks like a wallpaper. It's got some flowered wallpaper. It's got the classic flowers on the coffee table. And he's reading the paper, see. And she's reading the paper. And this is the way it went, see. It's dead silent. He finally says, did you read about Harold? Long pregnant pause. She continues to read the paper. Already you're interested in the way it's going. And she says, finally, what? Now he's not listening. Then he looks up and he says, what'd you say? He says, what? He says, what? What did you say? She says, oh, forget it. Long pregnant pause. Then he says, well, by George, he's reading the paper. He rattles the paper a little. In the instructions, it says, rattles paper. He says, by George, rattles the paper. Long pregnant pause. He says, what about George? He says, what? He says, what'd you say about George?
George who?
So I don't know. You said, what did you say about George? Who? George who? Is you talking about George Johnson at the office? What happened to him? Maybe she's got a paper. So I don't, you said something about George Johnson. He said, oh no, I said, by George. He said, well, why didn't you say so? So, well, I did say so. I said, by George. She rattles her paper. You see, with the implication, the way she rattles it, he is getting nuttier all the time. And then he says, do you read about Harold? She says, what? You read about Harold? Long pregnant pause. He says, doesn't surprise me. What do you mean it doesn't surprise you? Now she's not listening. She puts her paper down and says, what'd you say? He says, what do you mean it doesn't surprise you? She says, what surprised me? What surprise? He says, well, you said it doesn't surprise you. She says, what do you mean doesn't? Well, the play went on like that. Now, you know that a lot of people call this absurd dialogue. Now, doesn't that sound exactly the way two people are when they're sitting in a living room? They've been married 45,000 years. And they just keep, you know, making these comments. Well, I saw this thing and I said, gee, you know, that's not the theater of the absurd at all. That's the theater of realism. What it really is. Because realism itself is absurd. Now, how many times have you seen a Fellini movie? We have a person who can do great imitations of Fellini music. Would you please give us your Fellini music now, please? Would you please? You got your Fellini music? Let's hear it. Listen, I... That's the Fellini music. You never hear... with the bomb drums going? Well, every time we walk down the street and we see a Fellini scene, you know, a total Fellini scene, instead of making a comment, this person goes... Listen to this scene. Rome, Roma, Maria Luisa Macona, 24, came out of a train station last night, and a dark-haired man, who she knew very slightly, offered her a ride. You got the picture. She accepted. On the back seat of the car was a 3-foot cardboard box. The man drove down a dark street and stopped. The top suddenly came off the box, and a dwarf leaped out of the box, hit Maria Luisa on the head with a club. When she came to, the girl told police that she was lying in the road and $56 was missing from her purse. Now, that is a pure Fellini scene. A dwarf leaping out of a cardboard box, hitting you on the head and robbing you in the back seat of a Fiato. So I don't know whether, you know, Fellini may not be... working with the theater, they've said it all. He may be just telling you the simple God's honest truth, you know? Now, for example, let's take a simple thing. The reality of a thing. Now, I go to movies all the time. I rarely see any movies that's like the way it is in life. You know, they make a little attempt to, because life is so unbelievably greater than the movies ever show it. For example, now, right now, what is it? Last days of March, you know, it's getting to be springtime. And every time at this time of the year, you know, you get this little nervous feeling. The spring is coming, and you say to yourself, I am not going to louse up this summer. I'm going to wrench every last bit of ecstasy out of this summer. I'm not going to waste a minute of it. It's summertime. And I'm going to be right there on top of it, you know, with a bathing suit, with a bikinis, the shorts, the whole bit. I'll be playing a scene right out of every beer commercial you ever saw, you know, running around yelling, having beach parties and... all a whole bit. Well, this nervousness always afflicts it. Well, just at this time of the year, every time it happens, there's a certain kind of breeze comes out of the Jersey marshes. And you smell it. You know, smells, I think, are far more conducive to bringing back memories than sights. I believe this strongly, that's one sense that the human being, he lives with it. You know, we've got senses just like any other animal. And he makes very little point of it. We make a great point of the visual. We make a great point of the oral, the ear.
We always talk about sounds we hear.
But it's that little, faint, elusive, indescribable aroma that brings back just the total memory. You just can't, you can't escape it. Well, the other day, I'm driving along the Jersey Turnpike. And you know, there's plenty of total aromas along the Jersey Turnpike. And you know, all those things there, those big chemical factories and all that. There's one big mother of a chemical factory. It's got 5,000 giant smokestacks sticking up the air. And it's always going, you know, belting this great big purple cloud up into the sky. And I'm breathing it in. See? So I'm driving along, and this little aroma comes floating across the front seat of the car. And, oh, my God, no. And I remember Shepherd's Odyssey. Corporal Shepherd's Odyssey. Oh, every time I see a GI hitchhiking, I remember this. I was a corporal, and I had gotten shipped. I had gotten shipped from Maryland. I was stationed very briefly near Washington, D.C., out near College Park, Maryland. And in fact, I was at the university there, you know, University of Maryland with the Terrapins and all that stuff. And I had been dating a girl, at the University of Maryland the brief time I was there. And suddenly, without any warning, I am shipped out in the dark of night and thrown bodily back into the army. Where was I? Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. I mean, that ain't exactly the University of Maryland, friends, I'm going to tell you. So here I am. Thrown back in the army, see, back with a troopin', and I'm fucked. And so the first weekend comes up. I have no idea of the history and the geography, particularly the geography of the East Coast. All I know is I'm north of where I was. I figure if you go straight south, you'll hit Washington. So on this weekend, I had a pass, see, and I got out bright and early. I had no money, see, I had about $2.12 in my pocket. Because we'd been redlined on the transfer, see, so I had no money at all myself. But I had a date, a fantastic date that was all set up in Washington. So there was only one way to get there, hitchhike. So I go out on the road outside of Fort Monmouth, and I start hitchhiking south. Guy comes along in a pickup truck, he picks me up and takes me to Little Shrewsbury. I get out, and I can start hitchhiking south. Guy takes me up, he picks me up, and I drive another 12 feet to Eatontown. So I get out of this guy's car, and I start hitchhiking again. I get another ride after an hour and a half, and I find myself in Tom's River. Tom's River. Don't ask me how I got in Tom's River. All I know is I keep going that way. I'm going to find out. Well, what I didn't realize, I'm heading out to sea. So 17,000 rides later, I'm totally lost, and I'm in Dover, Delaware. I'm totally lost. All I know is that I'm somewhere in Delaware. I had no idea where I was, and I'm hitchhiking, and a guy comes along in a Hudson Terraplane. And this was kind of the culmination of the whole thing, see. He comes driving along in his Terraplane, and by now I picked up another GI, see. The two of us are just hitchhiking along. We don't know where we're going. I'm heading south, and I'm trying to get to Washington. And so here we are in Dover, Delaware, and over the horizon comes this Hudson Terraplane trailing blue smoke. And it stops. In the front seat is a captain. Remember, friend, I am a corporal. My friend that is hitchhiking with me is a PFC. So we're real happy. Hello, Captain. He says, get in, boys. Where are you going? And he says, well, I'm heading to Philadelphia. I said, well, I'll go to Philadelphia, too. I mean, I'm on my way to Washington. Philadelphia is near Washington, isn't it? He says, why, what a coincidence. I'm heading to Philadelphia myself. Get in, boys. I'd like to know where that son of a gun is tonight. We get in the front seat of this guy's Hudson Terraplane. He's a captain, you know, and he's a captain in ordnance. I can tell by little badges he's got, and they're the worst kind. He's got these two great big silver bars on each shoulder. And so we start driving down the street. I look around and say, yeah, I'm in a real officer's car, you know? And the smoke is coming out from the floorboard, and I can smell the rubber burning on the thing. The windows are rattling. And it's pitch dark. We're outside of Dover, Delaware, and I figure, I got it made now. I'm on my way to Philadelphia. We go about two blocks, I would say, when the car goes, it stops. The captain now becomes a captain. He says, all right, you two, I'll push. Yes, sir. Me and a PFC are pushing this car down the highway.
We push it for a mile and a half. He sits on the front stand. He says, watch it now, watch. We're coming over here. Get your back behind it. Now get going.
So we're pushing. Over the hill we go. We finally get in the ESO station. He says, you guys tell that guy to do something about the timing, okay? Take care of it, men. I'm going in the bar. We nursed that lout's car all the way from Dover, Delaware, me and that PFC. We didn't get to Philadelphia until noon the next day. And the captain used to be, every 5 minutes, say, all right, come on out, you guys. See what's wrong with it now. Well, of course, needless to say, I didn't get to Washington. It is now well into Sunday, and I'm hitchhiking north from Philadelphia. When over the horizon comes a Willie's Knight with a major in it. He stops and says, you want to ride? He says, oh, no, I'm just waving my arm here, friend. Keep it in shape, you know. Hang loose.